Hi, everyone. This is Camden Busey. Before we begin today's episode, I want to invite you to join us in person at four upcoming events. First, on August 4th and 5th, Carlton Wynn and I will be at Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary near Greenville, South Carolina, for their summer seminar, where we will deliver a series of lectures on apologetics and evangelism for the pastor. Then, August 28th and 29th, we're heading to Birmingham, Alabama, for a seminar at Cahaba Park Presbyterian Church called Discovering Christ in All of Scripture. This is a Friday evening and Saturday morning, exploring how every part of the Bible reveals God's redemptive plan in Jesus Christ. On September 25th and 26th, we'll host our annual theology conference at Lakeland Church in Gurnee, Illinois. This year's theme is the covenant of grace, one Savior, one people, one purpose. And we're delighted to welcome Dr. G.K. Beale and Dr. Marcus Minninger as speakers. Early bird pricing ends August 31st, so register soon. And then mark your calendars for February 19th and 20th, 2027, when we'll celebrate the 1,000th consecutive episode of Christ the Center. We'll host this in Austin, Texas. There'll be a live recording, a shared dinner, and conversations with longtime friends of Reformed Forum at the Hilton Austin downtown. Seats for each of these events are limited, but more information and registration is available at reformedforum.org/events. We'd love to see you there. Now on to our episode. Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. I believe this is episode number 963 now. My name is Camden Busey, and I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, back for another episode of the podcast. We are on our march for our 1,000th consecutive episode, hopefully going to get there February 19th and 20th in Austin, Texas, where we will be recording the 1,000th episode. And along this march, this long 18-year process, we've had our guest on the program. I think last time I counted, maybe more than 20 times over the years. Sheesh. So you're averaging more than one per year, which is pretty great. And I have with me one of our dear friends, Dr. Daryl G. Hart, Associate Professor of History at Hillsdale College. Welcome back, Daryl. So good to see you today.
Thanks. Great to be with you again. Yes. I was hoping to be on the 1,001 episode.
We'll see.
The launch of a new...
Yeah, the new millennium.
A new K, yeah.
The new millennium. We'll see. Yeah, we can work. We can schedule that. my original thought was to do 1,000 in a row. So, Lord, by God's grace, we haven't missed a new episode every Friday for 963 in a row. So we're really trying to get to that 1,000. And then I thought maybe I'll take 1 week off and then we'll start again. But I'm thinking now I might not even take that week off. But who knows how worn out I will be. But we could certainly do something. Maybe we'll have a potpourri episode or a no agenda episode or something. We'll just do a rehash. Maybe we could do
a
historical.
You got to be the Cal Ripken of podcasting.
That's what I've been saying. Yeah, I'm definitely trying to be the Cal Ripken of podcasting. But yeah, crazy. Today we're going to be speaking about some important topics. I'm very excited to be speaking about this new book, Protestants and Patriots, Presbyterians in the Age of Revolution, written by our guest today, D.G. Hart, published by the University of Notre Dame Press, 2026, brand new book. And I'm thankful to the publisher for sending over a pre-press copy that I've been working through. This is a really great book, and you've done some podcasts already. Already spoken about this on PresbyCast, at least. I encourage people to head over there, and I'll try to include a link to that particular episode for people to follow up with. But in this book, Daryl, if I've got things right, you're setting out really to answer a question that historians have asked in kind of a variety of different forms over two centuries, and it boils down to this. Why did Presbyterianism so often emerge as an irritant to British and American politics, especially between 1630 and 1800? So to answer that question, we're going to get into all sorts of interesting topics and talking about all sorts of things. There are a lot of new A lot of familiar names and historical events in this book, but there were many, many more, I believe, that were relatively new to me. So I'm excited to speak about this. But the whole project you write about in the introduction, or it might have been the foreword therein, that the book began, what, about 14 years ago over lunch in Dublin with Crawford Gribben and Graham Murdoch? Tell me about that. How did this book come about, and what really sparked your interest to carry you through such a, you know, this is an enormous project. So to synthesize all this material, you certainly have to have sustained attention for a long time. What was it about that lunch that kept you driven over the years?
Well, the perhaps embarrassing answer is that they were working on a book series, and I was proposing to write for that series, and then this went to a different publisher than that series. But I was relatively new at Hillsdale College, and here at Hillsdale in the history department, we talk a lot about the West. We teach courses. Everyone in the department teaches Western heritage and American heritage, and that has encouraged me and others here to think about big pictures that we typically don't think about. And it's actually the case as well that in Western heritage, and I wasn't necessarily thinking about this then, but we assign, I don't know who chose this when we put the reader together in 2010, we assigned Calvin's Ecclesiastical Ordinances. Mm-hmm. And, you know, getting students, even Presbyterian students, to think about Calvin and the four offices and what's happening in Geneva is a little bit of a stretch. But as it turns out, I mean, I think that Calvin's, and if I could read French and German, I'd know better what the answer to this might be. But Calvin's polity really was unusual. Mm. It was exceptional. The church had relied on rule by bishops from Constantine, at least, down to the 16th century. And Calvin was proposing something very different with assemblies or councils or synods. And that's in Geneva, and the French churches are following that model in certain ways, the Dutch as well. But the Scottish and English exiles who go to Geneva, Knox among them, but also Thomas Cartwright, an Englishman, they think Calvin's polity is exceptional. Yeah. And then that becomes a burr in their saddle when they get back to England or Scotland. And they look at the church there, 1560s, 1570s, and want further reforms. The Scots were more successful in that way in some ways because they were able to have a general assembly early on, I believe 1567 or so, or at least a book of discipline. The English church never really went that way, except for huge exception, jumping ahead to the 1640s when the English church came up with the Westminster Confession of Faith and Catechisms with advice from the Scots. We tend to forget about the English origins of the documents that Presbyterians use around the world, Presbyterians mainly coming out of Scotland or inspired by Scotland. So anyway, that was sort of the genesis of this teaching here. But, you know, then it gets into, in American heritage, the degree to which religion is a factor in the American Revolution. And we're here in the 250th anniversary of the Declaration, thinking about America's origins. A lot of people talk about the American Revolution being a Presbyterian revolution. Mm-hmm. And I think Congregationalists don't get enough attention, especially having just been on a Revolutionary War trip with students. And you know, noticing that the Bostonians were agitating much more than the other colonists, going back to 1770 with the Boston Massacre, or 1773 with the Tea Party, and then Lexington and Concord are the beginning dates for the war. In some ways, Congregationalists probably should get more credit for the American Revolution than Presbyterians have, But because John Witherspoon was the only clergy member to sign the Declaration, people then make certain leaps about Calvinism or Presbyterianism and democracy and revolution.
Yeah, but that's kind of a, in statistics, we would call that an N of one. I mean, it's one example, so it's a little bit harder to draw some sort of stronger lines or causal lines from Presbyterianism proper to the whole revolution, but people do that. I'm wondering about just the effects of teaching these courses. This is important. In the, I believe it was the Matron course you taught with us through Reform Forum, you were speaking more generally about your historiography and your thoughts and inclinations as an historian. And you spoke about lumpers and splitters. Did you tend, if I recall, that you tend more towards splitting, you know, finding the distinctions among things rather than trying to lump everything into one, neat and tidy organization or category. I'm curious, though, if that at all relates in any way to teaching big picture, you know, when you're zooming out and looking at American heritage or just the Western culture as a whole, and you're covering, you know, things for college freshmen, college sophomores that go, that span maybe for all the way from the Code of Hammurabi to 9/11, and you have to do it in one semester. Just the, what, how that changes you and as an historian, as an intellectual person, just in forcing you to think in ways where you might not be familiar. Or I think for a lot of historians, you know, the tendency might be to zoom in on a particular decade or an individual or a region and just spend all your time there. What's it like to teach these big surveys? How do you think that really adjusted your own consideration, your own study, your own books? Going back, I guess, to your book on Calvinism.
Well, I mean, I think it gives you more grounds for making distinctions. I'm still a splitter.
Sure.
And I think there's a lot of splitting that goes on in this book, and that could also reduce the appeal of the book, because I think even with my book on Calvinism, people in the different Reformed churches want to hear about their story, and they don't want to read about everybody else. And scholars will read the book for a variety of reasons, but they don't care as much about the particulars of the churches. But anyway, I mean, in the case of this book, I was thinking in particular of even just the basic word choice that we use. We call ourselves, you and I both, Presbyterian, even though we're Reformed. And trying to make a distinction between Reformed and Presbyterian, well, what's the difference, and why do the English speakers call themselves Presbyterian, and the people on the continent, the French, the Dutch, the Germans, Hungarians? You've been in Hungary recently, I believe, or you're going?
No, I did. Yeah,
there. I mean, you know, it's the Hungarian Reformed Church.
Yeah,
and those churches, immigrants come here and they set up Reformed churches, Reformed Church of America, the Christian Reformed Church, the URC, et cetera. Well, part of the reason is because I think this book shows that the Englishmen and Scotsmen who wanted to further reform the church, or the churches, Church of England, Church of Scotland, which are always separate, but then they become administered by a single crown in the form of the Stuart
dynasty,
monarchy from 1603 on. And that just sets up this really weird dimension where the English Reformation relied upon Parliament declaring King Henry VIII the head of the Church of England. And that is a lightning rod for Presbyterians. How can any human being, other than Jesus Christ, who's both God and man, be the head of the church? And Presbyterian polity that Calvin developed, Calvin wasn't necessarily talking about the supremacy of Christ as much as Presbyterians did, but that's one factor for Presbyterians constantly trying to reform the Church of England. Church of Scotland doesn't make that claim, but there is still royal supremacy over the Church of Scotland. And then also challenging bishops. And they really take pride in being Presbyterian in ways that churches on the continent didn't have to do so as much. They could just have assemblies or synods or councils and leave it at that. But the Presbyterians in England, Scotland, and then later Ireland and North America really did take their directions, their identity from church polity, which again goes back to Calvin's Geneva and Calvin's ecclesiastical ordinances, which again is kind of, it's not to say dull, maybe too much, but it's not exciting but yeah, and generally speaking, I mean, if you read books of church discipline or books of church government, they're not exciting. I mean, you know, and if you get into the weeds and you can see distinctions in the way discipline should be executed, et cetera, you can see all sorts of nuances. And I'm not saying that I'm up to speed on that, but that's what we're involved in talking about this, of Presbyterianism as a form of church government and how you run, administer the church and who has authority and who has authority to run the church, et cetera. But it then has this political dimension in England, Scotland, and beyond that I think actually does trickle down to the American Revolution. And it's a constant presence in political debates in the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, all the way down to, again, another point of reference for contemporary discussions, all the way down to Presbyterians identifying with their respective nations. Canadians do it, Americans do it, the Irish do it, English and the Scots. And there is a kind of nationalism that takes root as Presbyterians kind of moderate. They still want a godly society, and they're looking for not a Presbyterian nation per se, but very much writing their own story into the history of their respective nations as being an important ingredient in the cultivation of godly society, which again is a different kind of consideration of Christian nationalism from the one that's going on now, but it does point in ways to the contemporary advocates of Christian nationalism have some grounds perhaps in looking at Presbyterian history and saying, yes, this was the case. Christian nationalism was a real thing. Although it's a much different form by the 19th century than it was, say, in the 17th century with the Covenanters, who actually have a national covenant that commits the crown, parliament, church, and people to the true religion. And the Covenanters really are an amazing part of the story. And the part that I scratch my head over maybe the most, and I may offend Covenanters who may be listening to this, it's just a really quirky thing. They won't give up that national covenant, whereas almost every other Presbyterian does and say, okay. And it's that national covenant that in some ways leads to the civil wars. It's a spur to the civil wars of the 1640s, which leads to the regicide, the execution of Charles I, which is in the history of the West, I'm rambling here, but in the history of the West, to kill a king, to kill the Lord's anointed, to execute the Lord's anointed, is just huge. We teach this to freshmen all the time. David had the chance to kill Saul and rebuked his men for even thinking about it. You don't kill the Lord's anointed. And that's what happened. And it's hard to consider Charles I, the Lord's anointed, but it's also hard to consider Saul, the Lord's anointed.
Yeah, king like the nations. And then you got the glorious revolution. We'll talk, wasn't a regicide, but a, you know, an upheaval and an overthrow. There's all sorts of, I want to pull a couple threads here on this point. I mean, well, you're touching on really in many ways kind of the heart of the book, but there's two issues I think that it'll be useful for listeners to hear more about in the context. And the first is what you call the French connection, that the connection between Geneva and Calvin's ecclesiastical ordinances of 1541, and then its affinity or somehow like what I'm curious on this point, why it traveled so well with English and Scottish exiles. So they're English and Scots hanging out in Geneva. They're exiles. They eventually make their way back. I'm curious, what was it about their DNA or genome feed? I don't know the scientific terms. Like, why did they catch the bug more so than others and then take it back with them? And then what happened there? But then the next issue, and you take this in any way you want. We fast forward and speak more about the 1630s and 1640s. You mentioned the National Covenant, the Solemn League and Covenant as well. You know, that's an important revolutionary side of Presbyterianism that happens 150 years prior to 1776. So, you know, we're all over the place here, but we, you know, the revolution and the Presbyterian roots of it or involvement in it is the seeds of that are way earlier than, you know, maybe what George III famously called the American Revolution, a Presbyterian rebellion. If it was in any way, shape, or form, it didn't begin there, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So let's talk about that French connection, if you will, but connect some of the dots. Like, how do we get from one to the other, moving from 1541 to, you know, a century later to 1640? That line is really fascinating to me.
Yeah, it is. As good as I can get with this, it seems to be that the exiles in Geneva were overwhelmed with how great Genevan society was and how Christian the society was. And Geneva was, I don't remember the number of people living there, but it's a small city. And maybe that would suggest it's easier to clean up a city like that, even though Calvin faced all sorts of opposition, even into the 1550s. And part of the opposition was from native-born Genevans who were objecting to all these refugees, immigrants coming into town, especially the French, and having to take care of them. So, you know, and when you think about today, immigration debates and maybe disorder that might come from unregulated borders, et cetera, I mean, it almost was like an open door policy, seemingly, that Geneva had. It would be in some ways easy to imagine that it wasn't always such a great place, that there might have been some kinds of disorder there. But when it came to church life, with the regular sorts of services during the week, two services on the Lord's Day, and the sessions or consistories actually overseeing the lives of the people so that they were living, encouraged to live more godly lives and being disciplined. If they didn't, I think that made a huge impression. And it was such a different experience as far as the ministry of the church under a Presbyterian system compared to the Episcopal system in the Church of England or Church of Scotland. And so I think if you wanted further reformation, and this is really part of the Second Reformation when these exiles returned to England and Scotland, if you want further reformation, you're probably going to want to get rid of the bishops. But then there's the problem that there's the king or queen who's the head of the Church of England, at least. Uh-oh, that's not going to work well. So that then becomes a real political stick of dynamite. Going forward to 1640s, 30s and 40s, I mean, you made the point in some ways of the book, which is the Presbyterian Revolution was not 1776.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even 1798, which is the rising in Ireland, which is very much connected to Presbyterians there. It is 1630s and 1640s. That was a revolutionary war, which led to the execution of a king. And you know, I think George III may have been calling the American Revolution a Presbyterian rebellion because the Covenanters and Presbyterians were seemingly so radical in the 1630s, 1640s that it just stuck in the craw of the ruling class in England and Scotland, that this is what Presbyterians do. Mm. So the best word we have for it, we're just going to call Presbyterian, even though there may be Congregationalists and other and Baptists and others involved in this as well. Because again, I do think the 1630s and 1640s were the revolutionary moment for England and Scotland. And it took almost, 60 years to get out of it, or 50 years with finally the Glorious Revolution, which was a peaceful, bloodless revolution and the institution of a constitutional monarchy.
It's amazing. And then that brings the Dutch in, obviously, with William of Orange, and further entwines the Reformed family trees and politics in other ways. It's kind of wild. I mean, you're right in one sense that Scotland in particular was something of a laboratory for testing the potency of Presbyterian politics. What is there anything in particular about Scotland that made Presbyterianism, I guess, politically explosive in a way that even England wasn't, or English Puritanism, maybe because of its congregational influence?
I mean, the way I would answer that, and there are, you know, I'm not a Scottish historian. I dabbled in a lot of secondary sources in putting this book together. Mm-hmm. Many among them Scottish, very great Scottish historians, both political and church historians. But it does seem to coincide with the Scots having to sort of get rid of a Roman Catholic queen, and then James the Sixth, who becomes James the First, but he's a boy when he becomes king, and he has advisors, and among them are some very accomplished Presbyterian humanists. We tend to forget about the humanistic strand of Presbyterianism. Calvin himself was also a humanist, and people that he employed at the Academy in Geneva. But Melville and another name I'm forgetting.
So James Buchanan. Yeah.
Right. Were very accomplished humanists, at least in the histories of the Renaissance. And you know, it looked like expectations were high. The origins in some ways of the National Covenant 1638 is the King's Confession or Negative Confession of 1581. There is a kind of covenant then just for Scotland that pledges the king, who is all of maybe 14 at that point. I can't remember exactly. I think that's right. To promote the true religion, to oppose the false religion, which is Roman Catholicism. And in some ways, the Scottish Reformation gets off to a decent start, and there may be high hopes. But by the time James the Sixth becomes James the First of England, it's not over, but there's a real kind of suspicion among the monarchs, monarchy of England and Scotland, of trying to rule the church through an assembly as opposed to ruling it through bishops, and other kinds of serious or zealous aspects of Presbyterian piety that also maybe get in the way of what the king and his children, Charles I, might want to do.
Yeah.
So I do think that that is partly the explanation, that the Scottish Reformation seems to have more promise. The English Second Reformation really never gets going. There are Presbyterians throughout, meaning people who are writing in defense of Presbyterianism between 1570 and the Westminster Assembly, but they're by no means in positions of power in the church. They may be ministers here and there, but still, and they may have gatherings of fellow Presbyterians who preach to each other or present sermons, kind of an early version of Banner of Truth, but they really never take institutional form the way the General Assembly and the Book of Discipline do in Scotland. I mean, in Scotland even has, as early as 1560, the Confession of Faith, Scots Confession, which is, I don't know if you've looked at that much. It's kind of a peculiar Confession of Faith. In the sense, at least, when I looked at it I don't know, a while ago, it didn't seem to have very much on justification, which is a little surprising by 1560.
Yeah.
But one more, you know, kind of factor in this that I also think is kind of curious and peculiar, thinking about big pictures, but it could have been that the English church, at least, and maybe the Scottish church, could have gone Lutheran. It wound up going Reformed, but early on, Luther is what? He's 14 years before Calvin's conversion, Luther's 95 Theses. I mean, the Lutheran Reformation is going well before either the English Reformation or even the Genevan Reformation. And people who are leaning Protestant in England in the 1520s and 30s, they're not reading Calvin. They're not reading Boots, or they're reading Luther. But then, because of exiles from the continent coming to England under Edward VI, who was Henry VIII's son, appointed to Oxford and Cambridge and teaching there, the church begins in the 1540s to tilt in a more reformed Geneva or Zurich direction, which is really also kind of amazing to think. I mean, what would have happened if Lutheranism had been sort of the background to the English Reformation in ways that it just phased out and reformed stuff came in? And then, again, big picture, like, if you think about British colonialism and imperialism and how Anglicans and Presbyterians went around the world with the British imperial system, it's part of the reason why we have Presbyterian churches all over the world, places like Australia, South Africa, Korea less so. That's more the function of missions. But it's still a pretty amazing thing the way that Presbyterianism rode on the coattails of the British Empire.
Yeah. I guess one recurring question I have here isn't necessarily one that you raise at least directly in the book, but it's something I'm thinking about as I'm thinking about all these different topics. And it's perhaps this is a, you know, an unrefined question, but I imagine some people listening to this are going to ask it, especially in relation to the contemporary discussions on Christian nationalism. And it's this question of what do Presbyterians want? You know, what are they after? Is that even a question that can be answered? Is there a single answer, or at least a general answer? And then once they get something, you know, what's the motivation, I guess, to keep it? There's two questions on this, maybe specific examples to put some meat or some specificity to my unformed question. But after the regicide of 1649, you end up with Cromwell's Commonwealth. Presbyterians, you know, remain committed to a monarchy, partly because you point out the theological grammar of a covenanted nation was kind of lifted from Old Testament kings. And so there's some dimension of a biblicism there. I mean, but number one, I imagine it's probably not even conceivable for them to think about some other form of government. I mean, that's one question. They seem to be, to get what they want. They got rid of the king. That wasn't favorable to their, you know, what they would like to do theologically. Now they have a window of opportunity to start a new life, but yet they seem, you know, committed to monarchy. But then the other issue is, with the Glorious Revolution, a couple decades later, and then the 1690 settlement that finally made Presbyterianism the polity of the Church of Scotland, that becomes a very critical moment. They seem like they might have won, but the question there is, why weren't they able to retain it, or maybe even the reverse? What did they have to give up or compromise in order to get there, and why didn't it last forever? I mean, these are just sketches of questions, but things I'm thinking about.
Right. Well, part of what they wanted, and this is a real tension, and I would like to read more deeply in original sources to try to figure out if Presbyterian advocates were aware of this tension. Although John Coffey's very good biography of Samuel Rutherford does point at this tension, which is Presbyterians, to answer your question, they wanted the church to be independent. They wanted the church to be able to regulate itself and not have to have the crown intervening in their affairs.
Yeah.
So they really wanted the spiritual independence of the church.
Mm-hmm.
But they also wanted the support of the crown. They wanted to be the establishment. And maybe this makes...
have your cake and eat it too.
The obviousness of the tension there is more apparent to us this side of 1789 than it was to them on that side. But still, it does look like, do they really think the monarch is going to protect them? Even, you know, they kept citing the Hebrew monarchy. But I'm sorry, and I don't want to upset anybody, but that's like one failure after another. You get maybe one or two decent kings. So why would you, you know, rest your case on that? But it's clear they're not thinking of a political system like republicanism. Mm-hmm. It's monarchy all the way for them, but they want a monarch who's going to be a patron of the church, but also a patron in a way that will let them do what they want to do.
Yeah.
There was another part to your question that I'm forgetting, but
With the Glorious Revolution, you know,
why they lost it. I do think that part of the reason why Presbyterians lost it, such as it was,
mm-hmm.
was they regarded the covenanting tradition to be too politically explosive. And if they were going to be the established church of Scotland, and it still wasn't clear. I mean, there were still efforts in the 18th century to incorporate the Episcopal Church within the Church of Scotland. And it's still going back and forth, especially leading up to the Union of Scotland and England in 1707. There are various laws made after that that sort of give a carve out for Episcopalians in Scotland. But they know they can't be radical like the Covenanters. And so they have to moderate. And this Glorious Revolution really does become a time when the Church of Scotland becomes known for its moderation. And you could argue that in some ways it's kind of like 20th century liberalism in the American Presbyterian churches. It's sort of going along to get along, kind of cutting the corners off doctrines or certain positions in order to keep the favor of the state. And this, of course, leads eventually to the seceders leaving in the 1730s. And then one more frustration with that is the Free Church in the 19th century, who get both of those groups get frustrated over the establishment position, that being established, being under the patronage of the state really does bring along all sorts of compromises, mm-hmm. because you have to minister to everyone and not necessarily to the faithful, even though it's a state church and everyone in the state conceivably is a church member. And, mm-hmm. and that's really where you get the blurring of lines of the civic and ecclesiastical, make it hard for either one to be authentic in a way.
Yeah, that's another major issue. I guess this raises for me the question, you know, is really just the right Christian prince the solution to all of our problems? if we just get the right guy, is that going to fix everything? But the bigger issue here that you raise is the patronage, which is downstream of this intertwining of the church and the state. And that's a thread that runs all the way from the Reformation, at least through the disruption of 1843, which was in the Church of Scotland, of course, a big battle over whether, the patron or the regional landowner could just select and install a pastor independent of the church. But you also bring up issues regarding the Regium Donum, and effectively kind of like a little state salary that was kind of given to supplement the income of poor nonconformists, which, okay, this might sound like a good idea at first if you don't think about it too long. But then all of a sudden, you know, what are we going to have, like church welfare? I guess ministers have it now through lower taxes, you know, through the housing allowance. But I mean, what
exactly?
You know, what are we doing here?
I mean, you could probably tell us about that, Camden. But
well, I tell you what, if you go talk to five different tax experts about your ministerial taxes, you're going to get five different conflicting. One guy will be so dogmatic. You absolutely must do this. And then you go to the next guy and he says, absolutely, that's illegal. And you're just left trying to figure it out. What's going on? You know, who knows? I'm just in favor of a universal basic clergy income. I think that would fix all of our problems if we just.
Yeah. if we get AI sermons, maybe that'll.
I mean, yeah, we're going to, if AI takes over the role of the preacher, we're going to have to supplement the income of the preachers who aren't working anymore. And we're just seriously going to have to figure this out. And the government's going to need to step in.
You're bringing up the Regium Donum was one of the favorite, most intriguing parts of my research and writing on this. And, you know, it is the vestige of establishment. With the state providing support for the churches. And it becomes really messy in Canada. And I wish more Americans would pay attention to Canada for different reasons. And I know it's fun for Americans to mock Canada. And I know Canadians like to look down on the crassness of Americans. But the way that Presbyterianism unfolded in Canada, where you have in the 19th century, you have the Church of Scotland, you have seceders, you have covenanters, and you have eventually the Free Church. And all of those are conceivably wanting a piece of the pie of the state's support for the churches. And why is that? Because they're all part of the established church. I mean, the dissenters are not the seceders and the covenanters, but still they can kind of claim a kind of standing by virtue of having been in Scotland. Mm. Plus the Anglicans are there and they're wanting that as well. So the Canadian governments have to sort all that out. But it's also the case that the disestablishment of the Church of Ireland, which was Anglican, but the Presbyterians were getting a Regium Donum as well there. And there was great hue and cry about giving that up. But it turned out that a voluntary system of giving actually generated more support for the church than what they were getting from the government allowance. Mm. And it's really kind of a fascinating set of numbers that you get between, say, the 1870s and 1890s of how well giving up state support went. But still, there was this kind of beneficence of the English and Scottish and then British monarchs to the Protestant clergy, even outside the Church of England, which of course caused resentment among Anglicans themselves, that is trying to, you know, suggest that the prince, the king, the queen really is supporting, promoting the churches, mm-hmm. much in the way that Christian nationalists today want government to support the churches, the variation is support the public good, maybe without supporting the churches. I don't know if the Christian nationalists have really thought that one through entirely. That's another question. But it is amazing how long, even after the Glorious Revolution, you still have government support into the 19th century for various Presbyterian clergy by the British government.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, thinking, you know, turning a bit more to the American context, I'm curious about this as well, just at least make sure I don't forget to ask some of these questions in our remaining time. You mentioned Witherspoon earlier. He was the only clergy who signed the Declaration of Independence. Interesting tidbit. I don't know if I've mentioned this publicly. I think I'm freed from I didn't have a formal NDA, but I had a gentleman's agreement. I used to work for somebody who was had a large collection of Americana. You know the background of this, Daryl, but I don't want to speak.
Yes, yeah.
And one of the things we guarded was a copy of the Declaration of Independence. And, you know, so an original. I mean, I think they printed 20-some of them at the time, so it wasn't the one that was sent to England. But it is certainly interesting to read Witherspoon's signature and all the other people's on that document. But Witherspoon's an interesting test case, the only clergyman to sign that declaration. But I guess he had this sermon. Tell me about this. He had a sermon titled The Dominion of Providence Over the Passions of Men. But it's kind of like a civic sermon, like generic maybe. How would you characterize him? You know, as a covenanter, as not so much a covenanter, is he representative of Presbyterians at the time? Is he a unique figure? How do we fit him in? And then, you know, what does that have to do with some of the later issues coming up in like the 1707 Union? Well, how does he relate, I suppose, to this Scots-Irish DNA story?
Well, he was Church of Scotland minister, an evangelical in the Church of Scotland, which meant more low church. And even though he was a philosopher of a kind and a college professor, excuse me, and president and teaching philosophy and interacting with the Scottish philosophers, he, again, was considered an evangelical in Scotland. In America, he was probably more of a moderate, and in the Colonial Presbyterian Church, that moderation was a good thing because the old side and new sides were coming back together after the split during the first pretty good awakening. But my reading of this, and I'm forgetting the biographer's name right now, who wrote about, but his biography of Witherspoon, I think, makes a really good case for understanding Witherspoon as a Scotsman.
Gideon Naylor's biography.
And looking at Witherspoon's own support for the revolution or independence as a way of thinking up until independence and seeing that this other arrangement couldn't happen. But I think he wanted to look at the American colonies as a kind of province within the empire, the way Scotland was part of the United Kingdom, but it had its own kind of representation in Parliament. He wanted a similar strategy for the American colonies. Hmm. A lot of the colonists really did benefit from being within the British Empire, especially economically, but also militarily. They needed Britain to defeat the French and the Native Americans in the Seven Years' War, 1756-1763. So there were a lot of benefits to being part of the British Empire. And Witherspoon was thinking along those same lines, but then recognized along with other founders that it wasn't going to happen. Hmm. And so his sermon is a very moderate sermon, though, as well. And I think it's fair to characterize him as a moderate. He's for the war and for independence, but he's, let's be careful, let's be moderate, let's be virtuous, let's not get carried away with this. We're not radicals. Mm. We're not going to go to London and execute a king or something like that. So I came away from this book, I think, having a better understanding of Witherspoon and also more respect for him and what he was trying to accomplish, especially thinking about someone who's going from Scotland and trying to work in a provincial place, provincial in the technical sense, not backward, place like New Jersey and the American colonies. And even thinking about his own career, I mean, coming to that relatively late in life, thinking about his wife who didn't really want to go to the colonies and leave the homeland. Yeah. I mean, this wasn't when they moved, it wasn't as if it was like going to Plymouth in 1620 or Boston in 1630, things were more established. But still, there was reluctance to do that, and yet mm-hmm. he carved out a pretty important place in the church and also in civil society.
I mean, if we fast forward just 13 years after the American Revolution, we come to a key event that you mentioned several times already, and it's this revision of the Westminster Confession, Chapter 23. You call it one of the quietest revolutions. We revised that, and the significance of that is, to me, enormous. Do you think it's underrated? What do we need to do to recover this or understand the bigger, larger significance of this in terms of just religious history, not just Presbyterian history?
Well, I think we still need to know more about it.
How so?
Debates have been going on of late about, well, they didn't revise the larger catechism, certain answers in the larger catechism, which leave some of the old.
Is that because no one knew it? Or
I've made that joke, and then I yes. and people accuse me of, how dare you diminish the regard of these Presbyterians, these devout Presbyterians, for the larger catechism, as if people today study the larger catechism. Sorry, no offense to anyone out there, but
I know
it's a long document. The answers
I love
are
the
long.
Larger, but yes, people, we can take a joke. We can take a joke.
Right. But I don't think we know who was on the committee, who was, what the drafts were, et cetera. But that would be useful to know.
Yeah.
And it's also the case, we have to keep in mind that the Adopting Act of 1729, all the way back then, there were Presbyterians in the colonies who recognized that the language of the original Chapter 23 of the Confession didn't make sense of the colonial experience in 1730s, Pennsylvania, Maryland, New Jersey, elsewhere. So that they knew something needed to be adjusted. They didn't want, in the 1730s, the king or queen calling an assembly, sitting at it, presiding over it, et cetera, the way that Chapter 23 talked about it. And they also knew they were in a much more pluralistic environment. In Maryland, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, you didn't have, did I say Delaware too? Although Delaware's
Yeah, we can't ever forget Delaware, right.
But they don't have established churches there. They have religious freedom.
Yeah.
And Presbyterians actually welcomed that. Maybe thrive is too strong, but they did benefit from it considerably. First Presbytery, 1706 in Philadelphia. Philadelphia at that point is 17 years old. It's a basic, Ben Franklin hasn't even shown up yet. He doesn't come for another 20 years or so. So there's a kind of fluidity in those middle colonies that allows Presbyterians to set up shop and begin to organize. And it's also, important to remember that the 1706 Presbytery of Philadelphia, the first Presbytery in the New World, isn't a daughter church. They're not reporting back to Edinburgh or Geneva the way the Reformed churches, either German or Dutch, are still kind of taking their business back to Classis Amsterdam for approval or for review. Already there's a kind of independence to
distinctly American. Yeah.
Right. I think those are a backdrop to the revisions, 1787, 88, 89, that I still think just hasn't been done. I mean, when in retirement, I'll be living, God willing, two or three blocks from the Presbyterian Historical Society. I should nose around and see what they have there.
How close are you
in their files?
Are you going to be closer to Holtz than before or not?
No.
All right.
I'll probably still probably do mail order. No, I won't.
Mail order from a block away.
No, Holtz will be 14 blocks away. That's
Okay. Yeah. Well, we don't want to paint a picture of too narrow of a radius here in case your internet critics try to dox you or try to find you. But I do remember several wonderful old podcasts where you and I might have gone to lunch at Monk's and then made our way to a previous apartment, maybe by stopping at Holt's first for a cigar. We won't tell Ann any of this. Those are fun moments. Those are good days.
But I mean, I think back to your question, yeah. I don't think it needs to be underscored that we don't know how significant it was, the revisions. I think it was. I really do. And I think it's still kind of odd that Presbyterian churches around the world today, if they haven't revised chapter 23, what are they thinking?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very 17th century way of understanding, even I would argue 4th century, because I think the language of chapter 23 echoes what happened at the Council of Nicaea, which we celebrated last year. But there you have Constantine presiding over the assembly and kind of making judgments, at least the way Eusebius writes about it, in ways that's what the assembly proposed in chapter 23 for the English, Scottish, Welsh, and Irish churches.
No, I'd be excited to read more work on that. I hope you have the opportunity to develop the thesis and dig into this more historically. It might also be a little bit of a call for future scholars out there, people that are looking for important and timely topics. This would be really ripe for the picking, I think.
Yeah, if you have any graduate students from Westminster Seminary listening.
This is a great topic. Before I let you go, I don't know your timing here, but one thing that I love about reading your work is also just the reading list that it produces, because then I find other books that I want to go read and study as a result. Two of them, at least in this kind of final section, as you're starting to interact with the argument with the post-liberal moment, you mentioned two books. One's by Jerome Kapolsky, his book American Heretics. The other was Samuel B. Wiley's 1803 Two Sons of Oil. I was unfamiliar with any of these works, and I'm curious just about them. Let's start with Kapolsky's. I mean, this you mentioned is a serious argument, I guess, a restatement of the view that covenanter Presbyterianism is constitutively at odds with the liberal order. What do you like about this book? Where do you agree? Where do you maybe disagree with them or want to refine the argument?
Well, I think he's right about the illiberal side of the covenanter tradition. The Glorious Revolution, the American Revolution, and further adjustments that come in the 19th century are liberal. And that doesn't mean they're good. They're just liberal. And the covenanting tradition is either early modern or late medieval in its understanding of church and state and the place of Christianity in society. And if you're going to have a relatively free society, and if you're going to import or have welcome immigrants from different religions, et cetera, into your society, that's not going to work out that well, the covenanter position. Where I push back a little bit in the conclusion, I believe, on Kapolsky is that he doesn't necessarily recognize that the covenanters were in some ways planting seeds, even if it's in opposition, showing that liberalism needs to come. So there is still a kind of trajectory that, because covenanters tried this, we can't do that anymore. And that's an important contribution, as it were, to a liberal political order, which personally I am very much in favor of. And I would claim J. Gresham Machen is also someone who was in favor of that political order.
Yeah.
And I'll just say this now, you may cut it out if you want. I don't think Christian nationalists have read J. Gresham Machen and the debates that took place in the mainline churches in the 19 teens, 20s, and 30s. The other book, the Wiley book, I didn't go deep into it And I came to it by reading other historians about British Protestantism as it extends outward from the British Isles to other parts. But you do have this odd phenomenon where, and this happens for all immigrants who come to America, whether it's before the United States is formed or after, but they bring their expectations from Ireland or Scotland. And if they're Covenanters from Scotland, they may bring those expectations and want the churches here to adopt those ways or try to set up churches that will perpetuate those ways. And I can't remember if Wiley, I think he was an Irishman who had some connections to the 1798 rising, where they actually thought they were going to fight a revolution and gain independence for Ireland from Britain. It's a lot easier to do that when you're an ocean away as opposed to just the backyard of Britain. They also, though, had help lined up from the French, which Americans did also do. And we actually succeeded in getting that help in ways that the Irish did not, although the weather contributed to the French not actually getting all the way there. But anyway, to come here and think about the 1798 revolution as a Presbyterian revolution or rising as a Presbyterian revolution, and then identify with the American Revolution and try to write your Irish experience into the American experience is partly why I think Wiley is sort of fascinating, to see the ways in which Ireland and America map onto or don't map onto each other.
There are ways in which they do map onto each other. But he was a figure. He rejected the U.S. Constitution, didn't he? Because he failed to acknowledge God as the King of Nations.
Right.
Was that his argument?
Which is which is an early version of the National.
Right.
Not the National Rifle Association, the National Reform Association, I believe, which in 1860s, and A.A. Hodge was a member of this, who were calling for an amendment to the Constitution to insert Christ as Lord into it.
My word. There's all sorts of stuff. We've only really scratched the surface. We've hit some of the high points. Again, I encourage people to take a look at Daryl's other interview with Brad and the crew over at PresbyCast and other places. Have you done some other podcasts that I haven't seen? I'm not listening to everything these days, but I imagine
George Sayar had me on.
Oh, sure.
Early on, and I think I have a couple more coming. But
there you go.
Yeah.
Well, it's good to get the multitude here. But the book we've been speaking about today is Protestants and Patriots, Presbyterians in the Age of Revolution. We didn't talk about it, but it is published by the University of Notre Dame Press. If you want to hear a little bit about the background on that, I believe he talked about that on the PresbyCast episode. But Daryl, keep it up. I appreciate the work. I always enjoy speaking with you, especially about these topics.
But, let me ask you one question, Camden. And again, you can cut this, but who has the biggest audience among the Reformed podcasters? Would you say, do you look at the numbers?
I do. It's hard to know because, you know, the audio numbers are not public. You can see in terms of video, but the YouTube numbers vary and they're not always representative of the total audience. So we're certainly not the largest among the ones that are out there, but it fluctuates. We're often not, you know, doing stuff for clicks and not doing stuff that's often timely. We're just kind of mostly talking about books that come out. So, you know, what Reform Forum does most of the time is a bit more tame. But, you know, if we might have a professor from Hillsdale on to talk to somebody from American Reformer, that might get a lot of clicks.
Oh, okay. I remember that.
That's happened. So that gets a lot more views. So it's hard to say, but we're definitely probably in the upper third. I'm just guessing, but it also might be determined by how you slice it up, you know, and how broad do you go? Do you include, you know, more Reconstructionist theonomic podcasts in the mix? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like there are other people that are doing other type cultural and more engaging apologetic resources and material. And there's other people that are doing things specifically targeted for a YouTube audience. So that's kind of a media ecology question. But just in terms of pure audience, it's hard to know because, you know, these, the full numbers aren't always shared, but it's interesting. Something I think about. Yeah. We're not, we look at these things cause it's also a measure of, are you hitting the mark? It's a balance between populism or trying to, just have, just search for numbers and clicks, which is no good because if you do that, I think you end up compromising long-term, you know, effectiveness and whatever your specific mission or vision is. But at the same time, if you're only focused on your specific mission or vision or your theological distinctives, and you never listen to any feedback, you know, listeners included, then you can end up producing things in an echo chamber that are completely useless to the public. So these are the far ends of the extreme. And, you know, having an uninformed monologue or being entirely captured by audience attention. And we want to do neither of those, but it's a mix of both. I'm getting in the weeds here, but this is kind of how I think about things once in a while.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, if no one's listening, you might think, okay, well, why is that? Maybe we need to produce some more things that people are going to want to listen to. But if everyone is just fascinated with, oh, what did so-and-so say about this or that, then you think, okay, what's the real value of this? You know, so it's kind of where I'm at. But who knows? We can always improve our views if we started, you know, commenting on hot sauces and chicken wings and chicken sandwiches. It's another way to improve it. Anyway, before I let you go, Daryl, are you working on, what do you got up your sleeve now, that anything you're willing to share, any articles, any lectures or books that are currently in the works or theses that you're trying to develop?
I was just before we got on putting together images. I have a history of Independence Hall coming out in September. Couldn't quite make the July 4th, but... And this has really very little to do with religion. It has a lot to do with the founding, obviously, and with Philadelphia. But that was really a lot of fun to write. And it has inspired me to think more about historic preservation, which is also tied to the way that we remember, the way that we interpret the past. There's a lot of that going on with Independence Hall. But it's an amazing building because it is the only building in the United States of America where all of the founders were together at the same place. So you can go to Monticello, you can go to Mount Vernon, and you can go to the rooms where Jefferson or Washington would have entertained visitors like a Lafayette or something.
Yeah.
But to get all
or
of
that,
those
or that pub, men, what's that pub in Old City? I forget the
City Tavern.
City Tavern, yeah. But they probably all weren't there at the same time either.
Well, yeah, they were off and on. But it's just amazing to think about. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like, you know, Westminster Assembly and where people met.
I think I've heard it from you. I don't know where I was reading you on this, but it was surely coming from you. Independence Hall was used just for some like municipal storage for a while, wasn't it? Or it had some, some weird stuff that was
the city
dog pound, was it?
The city bought it in 1816 from the state and didn't really know what to do with it because they already had a city hall, not the one that we have now, that Philadelphia has now. But until 1851, one of the uses of Independence Hall was a dog pound in the basement. But again, people weren't thinking of buildings as historic much then. Where Jefferson wrote the Declaration, the house at 7th and Chestnut Street, so-called Declaration House, that was
raised.
Basically became a hot dogs vendor at some point.
Nathan's? Was it Nathan's?
The Franklin family did not keep the Franklin House going. Mm-hmm. They basically raised it and built new housing and business facilities there. And eventually the Park Service came along and leading up to the Bicentennial kind of recreated where the frame of the house and the museum.
Yeah, so. Right. Yeah. There's so much wonderful history there. I really, really miss it. I took my kids there a couple years ago. We went back and did some of the high points and got to see the stuff, including the Mint, which certainly wasn't there in the Revolution. Mm. But it's just, you know, for people that haven't been, Philadelphia is a great stop, and you can do all sorts of stuff in a day. If you got 2 days, even better. You could spend a whole week, but even that, just all the high points is right there in Old City, and
the Park Service on one of their many websites, and I'm really impressed with the Park Service in a lot of ways. It's worthy of criticism as well, but they have one of their websites. I found a guide to, if you have a day, these are the buildings you should see. If you have 2 days,
yeah,
and I'm including that in the book, and I'm taking it. I mean, you know, it's from the website, mm-hmm. so I'm giving them all the credit. This isn't my advice, but it still is a way of thinking about mm-hmm. the buildings that are there in the park. The National, Independence Hall is not merely its own entity, but it's part of the Independence National Historical Park. And
they built a tabernacle for the Liberty Bell. And and you could go, one thing, it's fun. Kids can sit down at this desk and they can make you take a photo op of them, and it looks like they're signing the Declaration of Independence. And then you could head over to the Constitution Center. Like, none of these were there when I first visited Philadelphia, you know, prior to coming out to Westminster. But it's really a nice little setup. It's a great spot. Well, it's good. Yeah. So we'll expect our check from the Park Service and the Philadelphia Board of Tourism soon. Our regium donum from Philadelphia on its way. But Daryl, it's been great speaking with you. I really appreciate the time, and I know our listeners will as well. Thanks so much.
Yep. Thanks for having me on, Camden, and I look forward to seeing you at GA.
You bet. Well, we'll follow up with that. I do want everyone to follow up online. You can find the pertinent links and everything in the episode description. Head on over to reformedforum.org. Thank you so much for listening and watching. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.